Welcome to the In Defense of Ska podcast.
There's a lot of like, okay, well, you like ska, name three bands that aren't the Boss Tones.
I'm your host, Aaron Carnes, music journalist and author of the book, In Defense of Ska.
And I'm your co-host, Adam Davis, veteran ska musician from the bands Omnigon and Link 8.
On our show, we aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of ska music.
There are so many great untold stories throughout the history of ska. The show features interviews with everyone from the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones to Fishbone, Fall Out Boy singer Patrick Stump, and the Police drummer Stuart Copeland. Join us on In Defense of Ska from the Consequence Podcast Network.
There are some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a large unexpected inheritance. An always-on-the-verge-of-death phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone, up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard, so you can get a new one. Just trade in any phone from our top brands on any unlimited plan. With new line on my plan. Additional terms apply for trade-in and pay off your phone offer. See Verizon.com for details.
At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger. And Future Stronger You can get started now by saving $28 or more when you join today. You in? We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need to keep stepping it up. And free fitness training to help you mix up your routine. Plus, most clubs are open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more. Just $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends February 28th. See home club for details.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
It's like back to work and back to school, you know.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's the interview series presented by WFPK and WFPK.org, Consequence, and the Consequence Podcast Network. Thanks, as always, for making your way here, checking out the episode, checking out the series. Of course, I do hope you hit the subscribe button. I put out three new interviews every single week, new and every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So it's a great way to keep up with your favorite artists and discover the new ones at all the usual spots. That includes Spotify and Apple Podcast, at NPR, WFPK.org, YouTube for the video versions, or anywhere you get your podcast from. You can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. Some of the recent guests I've had on the show include, Tommy Stinson of The Replacements, Idina Menzel, The Hives, Barry Manilow. We had the director behind the movie Landscape with Invisible Hand, and the director behind the Gal Gadot movie, Heart of Stone, along with Matthias Schweighofer. And the filmmakers behind They Clone Tyrone also talked to Madison Beer and Fosia, Bethany Cosentino of Best Coast. And we had our 800th episode special recently that had guests Keanu Reeves and Arnold Schwarzenegger and Rob Lowe and Monica Bellucci, Suki Waterhouse and Janelle Monáe and Josh Homme of Queens of the Stone Age. Just a few of the recent episodes and why you should subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. And that's me, Kyle Meredith. Today, I am so excited about this. Today, I'm talking with Jerry Harrison of the band Talking Heads. It's the 40th anniversary of the film and live album Stop Making Sense, which is coming back to theaters thanks to a new partnership with A24. So we're going to hear about the deluxe edition of the vinyl that was just released, the legendary Jonathan Demme film that not only just regular theaters, by the way, that's also in IMAX. We'll hear how they struck a deal with A24. We're also going to hear what it took to get the four members back on the same stage together. It's been, the last time they performed together was Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in the early 2000s. They're not performing, or at least they're not performing yet, that I'm told, but there will be Q&A sessions set up around the release of the film. So that marks sort of a reunion. I want to hear the backstory on that, so we'll get that. We'll hear about the new Dolby Atmos remixes of not only this live record, but what Jerry's been doing with all of the Talking Heads albums. We also get to hear about why the Talking Heads considered themselves one of the best bands in the world at their peak, around the time they were making Stop Making Sense, how talking with the original members has been a healing process, and why it doesn't produce many artists any longer. We'll also hear about his upcoming projects, one which includes a show about the Runarounds, which I believe is a spinoff of The Outer Banks. So all that and more, let's do this. We're talking Stop Making Sense. It's Kyle Meredith with Jerry Harrison of the Talking Heads.
Hi, it's nice to be with you.
God, what you've done, not just with the Talking Heads, but in your other musical incarnations beyond that, in the production work that you've done over the years. I mean, you are so woven into the threads of musical history, so it's quite the honor to have you on here. So first off, hi.
Hi. And thank you for all the compliments. It's I've had the good fortune to, you know, what did they say? May you be blessed by living in interesting times. And I think that I certainly was. And I've been able to witness and sometimes be an important part of transitions, changes in technology that affected the way music was being made, changes in style, and even changes in the place that what it means to people within the context of their lives, I think has changed dramatically. And you know, it's you can write it down and you can talk about it, but to live through it is a very different thing.
Yeah, that's, of course, that's been a lot of the conversation right now. You know, we talk about changing musical styles all the time, but the changing in technology, you know, only creeps up every so often. And yeah. And it's interesting to think back, you know, around the time when synthesizers and drum machines were coming in and people were worried that robots were making our music.
Right. Robots control, but at that time, robots controlled by people.
Sure. And now we have robots making their own music. So
yeah,
that's got to be it's got to be an interesting, I mean, I think everybody's got an opinion on this. And even to some point, maybe it's a tired conversation or maybe we're on the cusp of really being in trouble, depending on who you talk to. But that I think just taking the context of what you're talking about, that's got to be an interesting point of view for yourself who has seen the whole scope of it.
To me, the most fun time to me was, I'm old enough that I remember sort of doing a recording session where it was sort of like the musicians are in that room and then the technicians, you know, it's not how it was at Abbey Road wearing white lab coats, but they're in this room. And it's sort of like you're a circus act that's being watched and recorded, but you have nothing to do with that. No, this is for the engineering technical professionals. It's sort of like, yeah, you're a great race car driver, but get out of the pit. You don't know anything about like changing, you know, the camshaft or anything like that. And then the transition to when control rooms got bigger. And I would also say as a producer, I learned from Eno this idea of thinking of the recording studio as an instrument in itself and part of the whole process of making an album or making a sound was stuff that you did with your own instruments and maybe pedals and effects that you had built in out there, but also all of the ones that were available in the studio. And the early ones that allowed you to, for instance, capture a little space and time, piece of music, and then replay it, trigger it back, and things like that. Really exciting things happened. And sometimes it took you all day to do something that now you can do in 5 minutes, but it took you all day. And you were just so excited that you actually could now do something like that, that you could never have done before with just tape. Or, you know, or some of the ways that they did it with tape were pretty inexact. You could kind of do it. And of course, I think that they probably felt when tape came along, oh my God, look what we can do with tape that we couldn't do with, you know, cutting to wax cylinders and then to lacquers. Now we can splice it. I think some people say that Tom Dowd, who worked at Atlantic, is the first person who said, we can cut tape in the middle of a song and you won't know.
Which is still amazing to me because I came up right after that. Like I'm a child of the 80s. Right. So for me, tape was, you know, collage. That's what it was, you know, recording collage. But I never had the razor slices across my jeans as I, you know, I hear about and you know, and all that like that's still the art of that, which is absolutely a lost art at this point, is incredible to me.
And it was You know, and I mean, I remember even, and this must have been done analog, that I was doing sort of a alternate mix on the album Casual Gods with John Patoker for the song Bobby Don't Do It, or Bobby. And the way he did it is he had ideas and he went to a part of the song and he then recorded it onto a two track and he kept it. And then we went to another part of the song. He did this and then he tried editing them together to see if his idea would work, because there was no way to move things around to hear it in advance. You had to, you know, you got all your balances and you recorded it. And then you went and recorded this and say, like, what's this sound like when this happens at that point? And it's like, okay, that works. Like, let's go to the next one. And, you know, it was this assembly process that sort of first happened in someone's mind, was conceived. Then how do I make it work? I have to kind of remember things about the volumes of the drums. Otherwise, they're going to interfere. It's going to be very obvious. Things like that. So, it was so fun to be like at a, like, you really felt you were at the cutting edge of that, or when the beginning of samplers happened. And, you know, I made that record 5 minutes with Ronald Reagan's voice. And, you know, that was that, you know, bop, 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 bing. You know, this something that you could do that it would have been really, you know, they did shit like this at Earcam with tape. But it was super laborious, you know, and this, so it sped that part up, but not to the point that now it's just like everything's within this and the plugin does this, it's already done. And then, you know, sometimes then what happens, it's done, but it doesn't really sound the same. It's really not as good. But, you know, I do think that that's one of the big things now. It's like you have to at least to have your own taste about what you think is good and bad. When so many things can be fixed so easily, then you have to kind of look really deeply into the piece of music to go, what is it about this that just doesn't work? Because all of these external things seem fine. In the past, the external things were usually like, well, I don't think this is a very good song, and the singer is singing out of tune, and his phrasing's terrible, and so it's pretty easy for me to tell that I don't think this is going to work. But if all the tuning's fine and it's all been rephrased because you've moved things around by somebody, and now you're going like, all that works, but I still don't think it's a very good song. But
and you fix too much stuff, and of course you lose the happy accidents that, you know, are some of our favorite moments, you know, of any, yeah, that stuff.
I think that's a lesson that everybody who, when they first get, you know, something like Pro Tools or any kind of these audio editing programs, goes through a phase of almost making everything always perfect, because they were always so frustrated with, I always sing a little flat, or I, you know, I've always felt my drummer was slowing down here and there, and I got to fix that. And, you know, and then you get obsessed with it being perfect. And then you've, you know, a year or two later, you're like, I'm bored with this now, you know. And so, like, learning to do just the right amount, I guess that's the art form.
And we'll be right back right after this. Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with Jerry Harrison of the Talking Heads. And now, and I'll tie this to current day, although I'm sort of tying it to the far past too. Now you're working with remixing what's the Talking Heads stuff in Dolby Atmos.
Right.
Which is its own new level that I haven't fully grasped yet, because I don't know that I even have the proper, you know, speakers, whatever, system. Talk about that a little bit, because I would love to hear what that means for what you're doing and how that's adding something new, what that's bringing out.
Well, it is not incredibly different from when 5.1 came out, and which was the idea of, which really wasn't all that different from Quad, which had come out many, many years earlier. But the idea of, like, having speakers behind you as well as in front of you is the beginning of this. Dolby Atmos, of course, adds the ceiling and more speakers around you. It was easy with 5.1, if you didn't have the speakers in the right place, with sort of a hole could develop in it. And so by having more speakers, you could make sure that that doesn't happen. But you also have to be very careful that if they're not placed right, like, you know, if a speaker's right, especially in a smaller room, if the speaker's like right there, your ear is right here, it could be, this speaker can just always seem too loud, you know, and it's somewhat also dependent on the size of the room, it can matter. When we remixed all of the Talking Heads studio albums for Atmos, we used the 5-1 mixes as our starting point. And then we expanded them and for the extra speakers. And because we knew that they had worked as not feeling like that they were new, that they had special things about them. They had added clarity, the idea that in a song like The Great Curve, where you have all these different melodies of the background vocals, that you could, by placing them in different places, it could be sort of like Charles Ives having the two marching bands marching towards him in the middle of town. You had this, and that was totally cool. So, you know, we expanded on that. We used the ceiling, but we also wanted it to relate back to the original stereo mix, and that you went like, oh my God, this just sounds way too different. You know, we were trying to be careful that there was that that connection back. And we also knew that those mixes were going to be largely listened to on headphones, because Apple had embraced this, and Amazon Music and Tidal now have it. And so that's still a near field experience, and it does not allow you to get right in front of you. So, you know, the easiest way for people to check it out is there are now these really good sound bars that have been developed that find a way of throwing speakers off the ceiling and stuff like that, so that it gives the semblance of sound coming from all around you. It's not the same as having a really great system with 13 speakers everywhere, but it's remarkably works. I've always thought that, you know, I brought up that song "Bobby, Don't Do It," which is a song about suicide, and it has these. I have these sort of little buried things, which are sounds from a pig slaughterhouse that my friend Frank Serafini, who does sound effects, had recorded, and he used in the movie Poltergeist, and they're horrifying sounds. And I thought about that trial of Judas Priest, that someone went out and shot somebody because they had listened to Judas Priest for, I don't know, 10 hours straight with headphones. I think when you get to the point of really, like, really good Atmos, where, you know, you can't tell if it's in the music that someone's, like, scratching behind your head, you know, there's, like, that someone walked in the door, that could be part of the music, or it could be in your real environment. The idea of you repeating that over and over again and putting yourself in a violent mental state or an altered mental state seems a lot more possible to me.
That's wild. It's wild how, because I know those moments that you're talking about, how it's like, I know that I'm hearing it here, but I feel it here and I feel it. Even like when I was thinking like Chad Blake, producer, you know, he used binaural recording a lot, and a few of his, you put them on, and the whole idea about, you know, you're supposed to feel like you're in the middle of the room.
Yeah.
And if you get it right, it's perfect. And then on the extreme side, the new Sphere in Vegas that U2 is going to be, like, I'm really interested to hear it. Now that's more of a live experience, but to have that same sound quality wherever you are, you know, the things you can play around with is just incredible.
And I'll believe it that it's the same everywhere. I mean, we'll see. you know, they did that with Love, but that was because they had speakers in every built into every chair, you know, and as a way to try to make it the same everywhere. I mean, it is amazing what they've done with speaker systems and having micro delays. You know, there's a club here, Sweetwater, where they have ceilings in a, you know, they left the wood beams in the ceiling, so they have mounted littler speakers coming back, and with microsecond delays, they can have them in alignment with the speakers on stage, which then means to get a certain sound level to the back of the room, you don't have to blast it up front, because you have, it can be reinforced, but reinforced in time. So as well as, you know, focused arrays, which are remarkable at how narrow they can focus. So the technology is really astonishing of what they can do, and probably is going even more in that direction. But as far as surround goes in Atmos, it was really fun to do that. And, you know, because I really had loved the 5.1 experience. And Atmos, one of the interesting things about what Atmos does is that it has an in-between step that the way they describe it is slightly complicated. But what it does is you mix to a space, this multi-dimensional space, which includes the ceiling and all around you. And then the Atmos system samples your system. You tell it how many speakers you have, and it, you know, it sends pink noise to everything, and then it basically translates what you did into try and optimize it for whatever the speaker system that you have available is. And that is really useful because, you know, we would with 5.1, because it was channel specific, everything was sent to a channel, you could walk into someone's setup and going like, well, where's the center speaker? And, you know, because a lot of people would have like really nice stereo speakers, and then they added some other things to have surround speakers and the center speaker, but they're not of the same quality, or they're not even the same brand. And it becomes like, so when we were doing the 5.1, we compensated for that by using the idea of what they call the faux center that comes from stereo when you put equal sound in there. So our center was a mixture of the true center speaker, but also taking the left of the right and panning it so it would go in the center, so that if someone had an older system, they still would get the experience.
Yeah, as the kid who just loved to sit right in front of the stereo speakers, you know, with the liner notes, like.
And we just did this for Stop Making Sense, of remixing it for theaters, and then we had to do the conversion to for IMAX, which is a little bit different than Atmos. Unfortunately, I was in Europe when that happened, but I talked to everybody. It didn't go, everyone thinks it's an automatic process. You just let a computer do it, but no, you have to make some changes. And so they made the changes, and I'm really excited when that's going to come out. And I think it's really exciting I think what'll happen is that you'll now be able to go like, and this is one of the things in multi-channel audio is you can hear the whole thing, which is the mix that you're used to hearing. But if you want to, you can kind of go and concentrate on what's Bernie Worrell playing right now, or what's Tina, the bass is what they were like, what's that guitar part? It's like, oh, I can actually pick it out now. It's like, it's there over there. So if I think about over there and try and reject some of this other stuff, I can actually hear it a little more clearly. So it's really cool. And it also means it's easy to want to listen to it twice or three times and focus your attention in different places.
Well, when you're looking to, you know, run the box office up the theater, that's the best thing right there.
Exactly.
See it multiple times. And that's, you know, by the way, so this is being put out, you know, it's A24, which is one of the coolest in the game right now. A lot of my favorite movies coming from them, to pick this up for the theatrical run. How did that relationship come about? Because that's not something I think anyone would have instantly expected.
Well, what happened is the deal that we had had with Palm Pictures was coming to an end, and they made an offer which we felt was inadequate. And then it's like, well, you know, maybe they're still not even the right company. And, you know, I think that there's a truth that often happens is that even a company that's been very good to you, if you have a very long relationship with them, there are times where everybody does things sort of on automatic pilot. And so the introduction of a fresh relationship, fresh blood, as they say, you know, is, you know, an example would be Bonnie Raitt. Now, it's maybe one of her best albums, but when she did Nick of Time, it was when she had moved over to Capitol from Warner Brothers. And she was at a really good point in her life. She, you know, it's a great song. But they also immediately spent more money on it than I think Warner Brothers would have, because they wanted to prove to Bonnie she'd made the right choice by moving. And they had invested in giving her a bigger advance than she would have gotten to extend. So that the freshness of it helped make it this was the right decision. So I think that for Stop Making Sense, having a new studio, you know, we were, you know, there were a couple of other ones that were in contention, and we chose A24. We thought they would be the best partners for us, and it's been great working with them. And I think I don't think we would have been able to have gone as in deep of like, okay, we're rescanning it at 4K and we're going to spend the money on doing this remix and stuff like that. I mean, I was the one who put that together and found ways to say, the budget was really, it really didn't cover what we needed to do, but I found ways to make it work. And I think that I think people are going to be like, I love this film, but now it's like, I really feel like I'm seeing it with fresh eyes and with fresh ears again. And I think that's going to be a great experience. And, you know, I think that when we put out, let's say, a Blu-ray version, my intention is that we include sort of all the older mixes and stuff like that, and people can go back and I can talk through, you know, what the technology changes were and things like that, and how, but there's, you know, people are still going to probably go like, I kind of miss this, or I miss, there's always someone who misses something from the past. I miss the grain. I missed it when it was blurrier, because I kind of, you know, whatever that is.
That's embedded. I have old VHS tapes. Rarely do I pull them out, but every now and then, you know, that nostalgia seeps in, or just that connection that you did have to whatever that, what, yeah, I get that. Yeah. The trailer for that, by the way, was enough to completely blow me away at the beginning. I mean, the trailer I've talked about, Stop Making Sense, was put together so well. Like, yes, I need to see this. And it just reminded me of everything that I did love about that album, about that film, about, you know, what we all loved about the Talking Heads. You know, of course, we could go on about that for a while, but even knowing what you guys were doing live, I mean, and I know this is not new ground, but did you guys feel like you were an island? Because looking at that, even now in hindsight, it's like, nobody was doing that. Nobody.
We felt we were at the forefront of something, you know, whether it was, you know, whether it would be just what we were doing, but we were really excited about what we were doing. We felt we were as good a band as there was in the world. And our performances were really exciting. Great players, great interaction and respect on stage. The visuals were one of the things I think that are so great about them is most of the effects that you see being used could have been done in like the 1930s. You know, it's a guy walking around with a light, or it's like a slide projection. There was nothing, you know, that was right at the time that they're called Versalights, you know, that very lights, the ones that would aim, you know, that Phil Collins have invested in, which were a really cool thing. But had we focused on that happening, it would have dated the movie. Like, oh, you're right, that's when that came out. But because of the things that really David came up with, there's a timelessness nature about them. They, you know, you feel like that someone could do the same thing in summer stock, so to speak. And, you know, it just was cleverly enough done that, you know, you didn't need fancy technology. You just needed a good imagination.
And we'll be right back right after this. Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with Jerry Harrison of the Talking Heads. We see some of those drawings. I know that was in the even the original booklet and everything about this is the concept for the stage. And then you see the picture and it's like, it's almost identical.
Yeah.
Like, do you remember you all dreaming it up and the conversations? Because obviously a lot of work went into that.
Yeah, I remember some of them. And, you know, the rehearsals were a little brutal because David was in the double position of having to run out front to see what it looked like and then play his parts. And I also think that it was, I just did this tour with Adrian Ballou about basically based on the first version of the big band, which was a band that I had hired. And we had been, there's a show from Rome that's on YouTube that was sort of the blueprint of like, we want to capture that. And so that It's interesting watching Stop Making Sense, which I did, you know, I went right into working in Stop Making Sense right after like doing a month of touring. And it's like, wow, you know, it amazed me. Stop Making Sense only has two songs from Remain in Light in it, which is like, which is Cross-Eyed and Painless and Once in a Lifetime. It's like, I, you know, what a lot of people consider our most important album is only two songs from it. But also there was a looseness and a sort of musical as well as freedom in the earlier one, because you didn't shut the lights down on people so that you could see the projections from behind. So, you know, Stop Making Sense, what it was, is that, you know, the band it became like a entirely conceived for the theater show. And before it, had, you know, it had started as, how do we play this complicated music? We need a bunch of other musicians. How do we arrange them on stage? How do we actually be able to hear each other? And okay, here are the parts, but there's a certain amount of freedom to go where we are. And there's freedom. I mean, there was freedom still in Stop Making Sense of solos and various other places, but it was more blocked out, blocking in the sense of what happens in staging. Where do you, you know, this, you're in front of this person, you're here, you know.
Again, in hindsight, it looks like you guys were always on that track to have gotten to the point where now we're going to do something that's so theatrical, that's meant for the stage. You know, it seems like you were always sort of building to that. But at the same time, you know, I think about, while you only have two songs from Remain Alive, you know, of course, you have the newer songs on there too. What Burning Down the House at the time had become the biggest hit of your all's career. So you, here you have this one thing that's completely art house. And at the same time, you're running the pop charts.
Yeah.
And that works, you know, and everyone went, yeah, all right, buy the ticket. We're all a part of this. Like, so rare does that happen. I think of Beyonce's Lemonade. Mm-hmm. That is one of the great moments in the past 10 years where that, you know, that it has lined up like that or something. And are like, even, I don't know, because when you're in the middle of it, it's probably just work. But do you remember being able to grasp that odd contradiction of what was happening in your own personal zeitgeist?
Well, I would say that when I said that I thought that we were like one of the best bands in the world at that moment, that's partially why, because I knew that we had penetrated the consciousness of the world with having songs on the radio or songs in movies, and we were known well enough. We were playing bigger places. We were consequential, you know, I remember one playing Forest Hills and Madonna and Mick Jagger were like 5 feet away from me in the wings, you know, and that didn't happen 4 years earlier than that. And to a degree, of course, they're coming to check it out to go like, is there something I can steal for my show?
Sure. You know? Which they did.
Yeah.
But it is, what a great testament it is. And of course, you all are all over the news right now. I know you know that part. Yeah. You announced this first off and everyone's like, cool, yay, new version, theater. And then of course it comes along. It's like, and by the way, all four of them are getting back together on a stage to talk for an interview. And here you are at the top of the press cycle once again. I mean, it's, you know.
It's amazing, yeah. And it's coming out after Toronto. We're going to New York and LA for openings. But then I think it's literally going to be in 200 IMAX theaters in the United States and 500 around the world. I mean, it's mind-blowing, really. And also, what is it going to be like in IMAX? You know, how, you know, it's like everyone's going to be, look at that pimple.
And you guys are following Oppenheimer in the IMAX. That's right.
Yeah.
Oppenheimer to It's Not Making Sense. What did it take to make this? I don't know if you call it a reunion. The four of you guys are together for the first time in public for a long time. Yeah. Was that easy? What did that take?
You know, the first thing was, we had started with the business is that we own the film together. We have to work together to make a decision. Is A24 the right distributor for us, the right partner for us? So we had to have conversations about that. And, you know, this is something we did together. Then it's like, well, then A24 is going like, here's the offer, which, and we're going to get really behind this if you help us. And so it was sort of like, you know, there was like, obviously, you know, we need to work together to make this a success. And, but it's also, I think it's been somewhat of a healing experience for everybody. It's like, yeah, we actually can work together and do this. And this is something we're all proud of. The conflicts that have been, that people have spent a lot of time talking about, they're still can be looked up. You can, it's not like the feelings that made people say various things are totally gone or anything like that, but it's sort of like they've been voiced. Do you need to voice things like that over and over again? I made my point. If you're interested in it, you know, for Chris, read my book or read this interview, or, you know, David, I think, has had the success of American Utopia. The fact that he now has Here Lies Love on Broadway, has, he's the man of the moment. I mean, he's been working for really hard for 30 years, you know, since the Talking Heads or whatever it is, even more. And he's had, you know, some of it had to do with that when he did that tour where he did the song, I think he called it The Songs of David Byrne and Brian Eno. Of course, I was like a co-writer of about a third or a half of the songs, but he and Eno had just done a record, so the idea of the title was fine. And the, you know, suddenly more people were coming to his show, and he was having more success. He was having fun. He could do experiment with more things because he could have a bigger budget, you know. And then that sort of culminated in American Utopia, and then, you know, now he's had this exciting thing of reviving Here Lies Love that had been at the Public Theater, the National Gallery, or National Theater in London, on Broadway. And, you know, so I think he also has, that's been a, given him new confidence, but also given him like, let bygones be bygones, because why waste our time on these petty complaints from the past? And I don't need to prove anything like that, because I have proved it. And, you know, for myself, who really tried to stay away from any conflicts like this, I've ended up branching out. I produced bands for a long time. I've started companies. I've just tried to keep my mind interested. You know, it's really been great to do this tour with Adrian. I haven't been on tour in 26 years. It was daunting, trying to get my chops back. One of the things that I see is I'm watching Stop Making Sense, and I'm watching myself play a part play now, and it's like I feel like I'm moving as fast as I can to make the changes and get back and have my hand in the right place. And I'm using different instruments, so maybe it's a little more harder, but it's like, I see myself there, and it's almost like I'm talking to Bernie and doing it automatically. It's like, you know, well, youth and playing, you know, having been a touring musician for 10 years helps.
Yeah. I know those videos, like my relation to that is on so much more of a smaller scale, but, you know, 20 some odd years ago when I did play with a group of friends, and I see those videos and I go, I couldn't play that now. I mean, not without a ton of practice. I don't know how I did that. And I also know the feeling of, I have no desire to ever play with some of those people again. So, you know, to be part of a group that in one sense is so parts of the popular conscious and ingrained in people's, you know, nostalgia and favorite music and favorite arts. And you know that question that always persisted through the years about reunions was so much tied to someone's own nostalgia of wanting to get back to a spot anyway, you know, which is a rough thing, I think, for any career musician to walk that line. But as you say, to get to a point where, what does it mean right now? What does all this mean right now? You know, to be able to work together again, what a relief, I guess, it is for us to see some version.
Yeah. And it's really nice for us. I mean, it's going to be really, it will be interesting to be in Toronto and in New York and LA and sort of doing these, I think someone's going to be interviewing each one of us. And, at the, simultaneously. And I think it'll be, you know, I hope it's that everyone goes like, wow, that was fun. And it was really nice to see you. And it's nice to get caught up and to what else is going on in your life. You know, I keep in touch with everybody. I mean, not religiously or anything like that, but like, you know, usually see everybody at least once a year now. So
how are Chris and Tina? I know they'd had the accident last year. I mean, I imagine everybody's better
for Tina. It was harder for Tina because she had a broken sternum from the airbag, and that's you know, I've had broken ribs. It's like unless you put pins in or something like that, you could do that, but you can't. It's not like you can put it in a cast or anything like that because you got to breathe. I mean, they used to like wrap people, you know, and then they'd get pneumonia. And so, I actually think she's still in the process of recovering from that, but they've largely recovered. You know, they came to Adrian and my show in New Haven. So I saw them and we spent the night at their house. My wife and I did, because they live nearby. And they seemed fine, you know.
It's great to hear. There really is. I know we were all concerned when that happened. So,
yeah.
So, well, I'm looking forward to, of course, seeing that interview, that reunion. I'm way looking forward to seeing this film. And then, you've talked about it. You keep yourself busy.
Yeah.
Are there other projects that you've got going on right now? Are you still producing? Or you have the other businesses?
Well, then, you know, I haven't produced anything. The last thing I produced was Le Butcherettes, which I really loved. I loved working with them. And I think Terry is just an amazing talent. And I've worked on this. There's a young band that's sort of been put together that they may include in being like almost like a new version of the Monkees, you know, but a band about a, you know, it's going to be like they're called the Runarounds, and the director who does Outer Banks it's about people meeting and forming a band and then them growing as a band and them living together, then having other jobs. They have girlfriends, you know, so it becomes I don't know if sitcom's the right word, but a serial TV show about the growth of young musicians and forming and becoming a band and then them growing as a band. So I've worked on music with them. But I have I had a company that was about doing fintech, about helping young healthcare companies raise money, that was called Red Crow, that we sold to Alira Health, a larger healthcare company a year ago last spring. And then I have a company that I co-founded that's doing the first sort of innovative new thing about trying to deal with the problem of snake bites. And I've been heavily involved with that. And it's been 11 years. We were just getting results back from our first clinical trials. It's a repurposed chemical, so we already knew about safety data from it. It's designed to be that you get it early so that it could help get the first thing, get you to the hospital. Most people don't realize what a problem snakes are. Mosquitoes kill the most people because of all of the vectors of malaria, dengue fever, chikungunya virus, all these different things that it can happen. Humans kill the next amount of people. And they may catch up to mosquitoes with the war in Ukraine. And snakes are next. Snakes are the third most deadly species for us. They kill 125,000 people every year and maim at least 500,000, if not more. And a lot of people never make it to the hospital and die on the side of the road. And I'm not sure that they're counted. So we have something that literally you could have in your pocket. And you would take it immediately. And at the very least, it would help you get to the hospital. Depending on what the makeup of the toxins are in the particular antivenom, there are places where it might be all you need, or the amount of antivenom you need will be much less. And antivenom can be extremely expensive. In the United States, the current level of what it costs to get antivenom is $60,000 to $100,000 per patient.
Wow.
And that doesn't include the ambulance being in the hospital or any of that, just the pharmaceutical. And the reason is that antivenom needs to be from the exact type of snake that you were bit by. And there's enough speciation change that if it was made from the Pacific Northwest rattlesnake, by the time you got to Southern California, it might be only like 10% effective. So you end up getting 30 vials of antivenom at $3,000 a pop. And every one of those times, you're in danger of going into anaphylactic shock and various other, because the way they make antivenom is they inject the venom from the various snakes into horses or sheep, and they build up antibodies, and then they take their blood and filter it and try to have the antibodies that they're passing on to you. But there's other things about blood coming from the animals that you're getting that people have bad reactions to. So ours works at a particular toxin, which is called SPLA2, and that is also kind of regulates your overall immune response, because just as like you might die from shock when you had a car accident, not the actual wounds that you got. Maybe they will kill you, but you die from the shock first. And so this sort of is something that, like, it stops you from dying from the shock first, and that's why it helps you get to the hospital. So even in ones that have the concentration of SPLA2 in the sort of composition of toxins that make up that particular venom is smaller than in others, it still can be helpful.
It's just incredible to think about. Anything that's happening going wrong out in the world, somebody's working on that, you know, and sometimes the most surprising, like I was thinking, like, you know, how many things Bing Crosby was tied into. You're saved by this. You got bit by a snake and you get this treatment, and you learn later on, it's like, oh yeah, Jerry from the Talking Heads, he helped out with that. That's incredible. No, that's incredible.
Yeah. And, you know, I was involved with a very high tech, microprocessor design company, and we ended up having gigantic patent infringement suits, and finally settled for substantial amounts of money on those things, and that was fascinating. And then of course I started GarageBand.com, and I was involved with IOTA, and GarageBand became iLike, and so it's partially because I moved to San Francisco as part of the startup community here. And it was an exciting time. I wanted to be part of that. But it was also you do something, I did like 10 or 15 years of producing kind of constantly, even to the neglect of my children. It's like, a band comes. You're having to pay for them to be here, so that therefore you book the studio for 6 days a week. You only take one day off. You work 11 or 12 hours every day, because that's how you get it done. And I always try. I had a philosophy of recording is to make sure that the band really could take the time to experiment and find, realize that something won't work and that this is the right decision. And I also think that I, as a producer, I'd had enough success with the Talking Heads and, that I didn't feel that I had to make every album, it was my album because I produced it, but it was not I didn't try to like insert always my style into it as a player. I was perfectly happy to play on records, and there were times where everyone else had kind of exhausted what they think. Like, well, I have these ideas that have ended up solving a problem. But the great thing about producing was that you got to work on music that you probably wouldn't do yourself. I produced a band that was not a strict country band, but it was very country influenced. Producing Kenny Wayne Shepherd, like a fantastic blues guitar. The amount I learned about the blues from Kenny and from Chris Layton and Tommy from Double Trouble, I played blues music in high school, and it's like I go back and listen to some of the records, mainly a lot of English blues, and I go, this is really, it's not really right, I just had thought it was fantastic, and then you listen to like, oh, I understand a shuffle much better than I did back then. You know, so that's the great thing about producing is you can push yourselves, but you have something to offer, but you're learning from the people that you're working with too.
And whatever it was in the water up there in, you know, Wisconsin with you and producers and you and Butch Vig and the garbage crew and everything else and everything that seems to come out of there, I'm like, what a magical place. And what was it you said in the other interview about 3 out of the 5 members of your high school band went on to career musicians, and you had all of these other folks that went to your high school that also ended up in this, like, something a little magical about whatever there was really, happening
really,
around there.
There really was, yeah. The guitar player was Leonard Cohen's guitar player for 25 years and played with Don McLean and Ian Matthews. And the bass player was Johnny Winter's bass player for 10 years. And then he had his own band, but he also like toured with Bo Diddley and Mick Taylor and all of these other people. Actually, the singer became the head of the American Institute of Architects. And the drummer went and was a Marine and fought in Vietnam, amazingly. And he then came back and was a physician's assistant up in Seattle. So everyone, and then the Zucker brothers, who made Airplane, were all part of art. There was quite a interesting art scene in that small suburban high school in a completely unlikely place that they would come from.
Well, it seems like you've landed in those spots over and over through the years. And again, I'll just say, you know, Talking Heads and in theaters. And of course, the album is out now. I see that. So I can't wait to see this again. And Jerry, thank you so much for all that you've done for music, but especially for taking the time to talk about it today. This has been a real honor.
Well, it's been my pleasure. And I look forward to the next time we do it and meeting you in person.
And my thanks to Jerry Harrison. Stop Making Sense 40th anniversary. The vinyl edition is already out, with the film back in theaters this September. Thanks to you for checking out the episode. Again, I do hope you hit that subscribe button. You're going to get 3 brand new interviews sent to you every single week. A new one every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to keep you up to date on your favorite artists and discover the new ones. Again, it's Spotify and Apple Podcasts. You can grab us at NPR, WFPK.org, YouTube for the video versions. Anywhere you get your podcasts from, you can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. And then after that, head over to WFPK.org. That's where I do a show Monday through Friday, starting at 6 p.m. Eastern. It's 4 hours of classic tracks, the best in new music. We got anniversary spins, bonus interviews, lots of music news as well. One of my recent episodes featured the music of Morrissey, the Cranberries, the Cramps, Bully, Harry Nilsson, Tom Petty, Fleetwood Mac. We had Gary Clark Jr. and the Arctic Monkeys, Beck, Phoenix, Billie Holiday, The Who, Dylan, Middle Kids, My Morning Jacket, Jason Isbell, Soul to Soul, The Last Dinner Party, Modern English, Peter Gabriel, and my interview with Bruno Major. That's just an example of what you get every weeknight at 6 p.m. at WFPK.org. Consequence has your music and film news. You can also find me on the old social media spots. All the social medias, the address is always the same, at Kyle Meredith. So I do hope you like and follow along. And that does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
You bet. Thanks. Bye-bye.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
There are some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a large unexpected inheritance. An always-on-the-verge-of-death phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone, up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard, so you can get a new one. Just trade in any phone from our top brands on any unlimited plan. With new line on my plan, additional terms apply for trade-in and pay off your phone offer. See Verizon.com for details.